On the screen. So let's do the Metta Sutta in English together. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn Bhavani. I'll hand over to you. I know you know what to do. Thank you.
Okay, I hope so. I'm not sure. I just let's see what. Anyway, we'll try. Okay. Everyone, so nice to see you all. And as usual, we're going to do the start off with just talking a little bit about meditation practice. Just cover the basic stuff. And it's fascinating how profound the basic things actually are, because the basic things are really just about, you know, being able to relax, being able to be aware in the present. And then as your awareness increases, then kind of gradually maybe becoming aware of the breath or doing metta meditation. And if you can do these basic things on the path, these basic things of meditation, well, basically, it will take you all the way. Yeah, it is incredibly simple. And it's one of those things that I always found so powerful in one of the famous suttas of the Buddha. This is the sutta on what is called, known as dependent liberation. It's called dependent liberation because everything in Buddhism depends on something else. Nothing kind of stands alone. This is one of the things which is special about the Buddha's teachings. There's nothing there which is independent or outside of conditioned phenomena or worldly phenomena. Everything is influenced by other things. So everything is conditioned. And because of that, everything depends on other things. And that's why liberation itself is a dependent phenomenon which arises dependent on other things. And in this series of dependent liberation, yeah, it says that it cannot be done by an act of will. Chaitanya in Pali is this idea of will. Yeah, so it cannot be done by an act of will. So the whole point is to be able to get the will out of the way. And what does it mean to get the will out of the way? Well, it means to be able to just allow things to be. Yeah, it specifically says that the path or the liberation happens naturally. It happens dhammata. The word dhamma in Pali is very interesting. Of course, dhamma means the teachings of the Buddha. But it also has the idea of nature. Yeah. So when we say things are dhammata, according to dhamma, it means they are according to nature. So the whole thing is just a natural process. And really what it comes down to is the ability just to stand back and allow the process to happen, not to get involved. And this is all that meditation really is about. Maybe a little bit more than that, maybe not entirely all, but close to being all that meditation is about, the ability to stand back and allow the process to happen. But that is surprisingly difficult. And it is surprisingly difficult, not because it is hard to do in the sense of, you know, you have to be very intelligent or intellectual, anything like that. It is hard because it goes against our habits. That is why it is difficult. So we need to recondition our mind. We need to kind of learn to do things in a way that we are not used to. And this is one of those very important things that we have to do on when we meditate. And we have to do it in the present, when we come to sit down to do our meditation, we have to do it then. But we also have to do it generally throughout our life so that we are kind of primed and ready when we finally come down to do our meditation practice. There's one more thing I should probably mention very briefly. I'll come back to this after the meditation. And that is, of course, the foundation for all of meditation, the foundation for being able to let go is always sila in Buddhism. Yeah, sila being morality. Morality not just in the negative sense of avoiding bad things, but morality in the positive sense of doing what is right and what is good. This is also very, very significant. So the more we can do that in our daily life, the more we can keep on purifying ourselves, the more ability we will have to let go and just enjoy the meditation when we come down to it. But now what I want to talk about is just very briefly about how to let go, how to allow things to be. And one of the ways of doing this, there is a number of little techniques that you can use. Yeah, I remember many years ago, Ajahn Brahm says it is like going to sleep, yeah, when you meditate. So you can pretend that you're going to sleep. Yeah, so it's a bit dangerous because sometimes you actually do fall asleep. And then, of course, then you lose out on the entire meditation experience. But it's similar to that because when you go to sleep, well, you have to let go. Yeah, you know what it's like if you are thinking too much, you can't fall asleep, right? The mind is active. So going to sleep requires that ability to let go. And then the mind then you tune out and then you fall asleep as a consequence. So meditation is like that. It's a similar kind of thing of letting go as when you go asleep without the falling to sleep. The similar kind of letting go. So if that works for you, you can try to ask yourself, yeah, what do you do when you fall asleep? And you can do a similar kind of thing that leads up to that to enable the mind to become peaceful. But one of my favorite ways of dealing with the mind in meditation, to kind of allow it to let go and to allow it to become peaceful, is to do a little bit of death contemplation. Or maybe we can do a death contemplation today and see how that works. Yeah, and see if we can kind of make it work for anyone. The idea of death contemplation is actually very important in the suttas of the Buddha. It is something that you see in a number of places. The Buddha says this is something that everybody should do, regardless of whether you are a monastic or a lay person, whether you are female or male, or whether you are, he doesn't say whether you are a god or a ghost, they don't kind of count, but maybe they are also included somehow, the gods. Yeah, if the gods want to, actually, the gods should really do this because they think they are permanent. Yeah, the gods have some serious delusion problems. The gods should definitely contemplate death. In fact, you find the suttas where the Buddha goes to the gods and he says, okay, you guys, you know, you may be very happy and you may be very beautiful and very powerful, but, you know, you're mortal just like us. And the gods are kind of, what? We are mortal. That's scary. And the gods get scared and they kind of, they get on with their practice. Yeah, they start to become more kind. Maybe they do some meditation in the heavenly realm. I don't know. There is no record anywhere in the suttas of the gods doing meditations. I'm not sure whether they do it, but they certainly practice morality. Yeah, this is one of the great things about the gods. So death contemplation is very powerful, something everyone should do. And I think the you know, one of the things that it does, obviously, is that it gets your priorities sorted out. It reminds you of what really is important in life. It reminds you that all of the things that we hold on to in this world, they will have to go one day. You can't take it with you into the future, whatever that future is. You have to let it go. And that is a very powerful thought because it diminishes the importance of so many of the things that we take as being important in our lives. Yeah, and this, of course, is a very important part of the idea of being able to let go of diminishing the importance of the worldly things, that the mind can instead turn to what is spiritual. The spiritual things are that which sustains you, from a Buddhist point of view, also after you pass away, after you die. Yeah. And it makes it very clear what is important. It gets your priorities right. Part of this, and one of the reasons why it is so useful to talk about now, is that the process of dying and the process of meditation are very similar. They are very closely related to each other. And that is very fascinating. And what that means is that if we use the idea of dying now as a, you know, as a proxy, if you like, to meditation practice. Yeah, you use the thought to kind of go through the process, you go through the moves and the process of dying to give you some idea of what it is that you have to let go of. It actually approximates to what meditation practice is about. The things that you have to let go of in the dying process are exactly the same things that you have to let go of in the meditation process. It's the same kind of things. So the two are in very, very parallel to each other. So instead of, you know, waiting with all of these things until we die, we kind of bring the perception of death, the idea of death, the contemplation of death, the mindfulness of death. We bring that into the here and now to enable the meditation practice. We use this as a tool to make meditation possible. Yeah, okay, I'm going to die. I mean, why am I so worried about all these silly problems in life? Why am I worried about all these tiny little negligible things? Yeah, you know what it is like in life, how we get caught up in little things that actually are not really all that important. Yeah, why am I thinking about these things? Okay, let it all go. What if I die in an hour? Am I going to be worried about these things? Of course not. You're going to let it go. You're going to let it be. It doesn't matter anymore. You get your priorities straight. You let go. And you remind yourself, what is it like to be on your deathbed? What is it like to know that you're coming to the very end of your life? Maybe you have a few hours left. What does it feel like to lie on your deathbed knowing that you're going to die very soon? And if you think about this in the right way, you realize there's two things that will happen when you lie on your deathbed. And the main thing is that you know that you have to let go. Yeah, you have no doubt. You know that this is it. I'm coming to the end of my life. I have to let go. And because you know that, there is something that compels you and drives you to do this in a very powerful way. And for that reason, you find that many people do actually become peaceful on their deathbed because they are forced to let go by the nature of the dying process. Yeah, so we try to bring that into the present moment. Try to feel that sense of, okay, I have to let go. Well, if I have to let go, I better do it. Yeah, otherwise it's going to be much worse. If we cannot let go, the dying process is going to be much more difficult as a consequence. And the other thing that happens on your deathbed is, of course, because you are letting go, the mind tends to become peaceful. Yeah, it's as if you don't have a future anymore. There's nothing to look forward to in this world. This world has to be left behind. And because of that, you tend to become very peaceful. And also, you become alert. Yeah, this is the weird thing. You become clear. The hindrances are low. The mind is present. It's not as if you go to sleep because you're letting go. You actually become alert and mindful at the same time. So there's this. And you can see why then this is so useful for meditation practice. Yeah, you are letting go and you give rise to mindfulness at the same time. Two of the things that we have to do to enable meditation to work. So if we can draw this into our meditation practice, it becomes very useful and very powerful. And so that is one part of it. We use the meditation or use the idea of death into our meditation. And I think that's probably, there is a reverse way that it works as well. The whole idea of getting used, or another way, the idea of getting used to dying is regardless, it is very, very, it is a very good thing to do, because we're all going to have to go there one day. Yeah, otherwise we have to live forever, which is probably even worse. So maybe we should be thankful for death in a certain way. One day we're going to get there. And of course, this idea of bringing this into your meditation means that you get used to the idea of dying. And also, if it is true that death and meditation practice are very similar to each other, and I would say they are, it's very obvious that they must be, and you know the joy and happiness of meditation, at least sometimes, yeah, when you're able to let go, when meditation really works, it can be a very beautiful and delightful thing. Then you stop worrying about death, yeah, because you realize the death experience, if it is like this, well, death also is likely to be a very nice experience. Yeah, for good people, dying is not a bad thing. For bad people, it's a bit more dicey. But for good people, there's nothing too much to worry about. The process usually is a beautiful process. So let us try to do a little bit of death meditation together. I will take you through a guided death meditation. And we'll see how that works out. Just sit down as you normally do. Find yourself a nice and comfortable posture. And start off by, as usually, by feeling your body. Close your eyes. And start off by just feeling your body, making sure that you have no pains or problems anywhere. Just adjust yourself a little bit so you feel at ease and relaxed. Nothing is too tight or uncomfortable. And just carry on with feeling your body for a few minutes. And just stay with the body for a while, just to allow the body to relax properly, allowing the world to fade away into the background, and make sure that you are really relaxed, really at ease, really comfortable just sitting there before you do anything else in your meditation practice. And to be able to relax properly, it is important to have a positive perception inside, a perception that is not negative in any way or complaining or anything like that, but a feeling of goodness inside. And one of the ways of doing that is to just have a sense of gratitude, gratitude for having a group like the Armadale group, groups like the Buddha Society, the Buddha to give us teachings, wonderful teachers around the world, all the Kalyanamittas being together, trying to make this practice of liberation happen in your life. And what a wonderful thing that is, to have that support and guidance, have professionals who do this almost for a livelihood, everyone supporting each other. And if you find yourself thinking too much about all kinds of worldly things, just remind yourself very gently that it is on the spiritual path that you find real meaning, real purpose, real goals. In the world, it's just an endless merry-go-round with no real goals, no real purposes. What you're doing now is what really matters. Let go of the superficial worldly things and move towards the profound and meaningful spiritual things instead. And now I will take the meditation in a slightly different direction. We'll try to do a death contemplation. And please only follow along if you feel comfortable. Otherwise, just do whatever you feel is appropriate. So start this meditation by imagining yourself on your deathbed. You are in a small room. The door is closed. There are no windows. There is no decoration on the walls or anywhere. The room is white. The ceiling is white. You're lying on your back on a very simple bed with white linen. A thin mattress, just enough to give you support without being pleasurable, without being painful. And you're wearing like a white gown of some sort. There's nothing there of any interest. You have already said goodbye to all the people in your life. You will not be meeting anyone between now and the point of your passing away. You only have one thing to look forward to right now, and that is the moment of dying. What does that feel like? And as you are lying on this bed in this very simple room, it is becoming very obvious to you that you have to give up all the things that belong to this world. And the most obvious things that you have to let go of are all the possessions in your life. Everything that you own, including your house, your most dearest things that you have maybe been given by people in your life, whatever it is, everything you own in this world has to be given up. So give it up now. And as the moment of your dying is getting closer and closer, you realize that there is more to be let go of from this world. All the people in your life, all your friends and acquaintances, all your family members, the people who are the most close to you, all of those people will have to go now. From here on, you have to move forward in solitude, by yourself, enjoying your own company. So let go of the holding on of the attachment to these people and move on your own into your own future. And as you are approaching your death, you realize there's even more that you have to let go of. And so much of your identity, of who you take yourself to be, is tied up with this world. Your gender, your education, your social status, whether you are poor or wealthy or in between, your nationality, all of these things are connected to this world and also much more. So let go of that sense of identity. Let go of all of these things that you take yourself to be. Leave it behind, because it is meaningless in the face of death. Can you feel that delightful sense of emptiness inside? Can you feel how beautiful it is to let go of the burden of identity and personality? And just feeling the emptiness. All you have with you are the good qualities of your heart. And you realize that is all that you actually need. And you are getting very close to the time of dying. Yeah? And you realize the last thing that you have to let go of is your body. Yeah? So let go of that attachment and holding on and identifying with the body. Yeah? Just allow the body to be. Yeah? And now know that you have to move on without it. And there comes a point in this process where you are no longer sure whether you are dead or alive. All you know is that you are giving up so much. And what a delightful feeling it is to give up the things of the world. It is as if a burden has been lifted from your heart. And you feel, all you feel is this beautiful sense of emptiness and liberation inside. So carry on with that feeling of emptiness inside, just bringing your good qualities forward into the future. And as you feel this delightful feeling of this process, you start to wonder why you ever were afraid of dying. Dying, when done in the right way, is just such a pleasure. It is such an unburdening of the things of the world, and is moving on in a beautiful way into the future. And maybe you start to feel even more delight when you reflect on that. And you start perhaps to feel a sense of gratitude, gratitude to all those people who made it possible to go through this beautiful process of dying, something that we are often so fearful and anxious about turns out to be so beautiful because of how we have lived our life and all the good Kalyanamittas and spiritual friends that we have had. So thank you, all those spiritual friends who have made this possible. Thank you for being part of my journey. I wish you all the very best. And you realize that in a certain sense, all the beings, all the people, everyone in this world has a part in this. So visualize the whole earth in your mind's eye, this beautiful planet of blue and green and brown and white. And I wish all the beings there, visible and invisible, I wish you all happiness and well-being. And now, towards the end, just come back to your breath and stay with your breath for a few moments. And before we come to the end, just take a few moments to ask yourself, how do you feel now? And if you do feel a bit more peaceful, at ease, whatever it is of positive feelings, if you feel the positive feelings have increased, and ask yourself why that is the case. In this way, learn about the path of meditation practice. Okay, everyone. So there you are. So are there any questions or comments or anything about the meditation or anything around that before we go on to other things? Anyone want to say anything about their meditation experience, or what works, or what doesn't work, or anything at all? Everyone okay? Yeah? Okay.
Doesn't look like anyone's going to ask anything, Asha.
Okay, that's fine.
You're welcome to give a talk, and then at the end, maybe people will have questions.
Okay, sure, let's do that. Great, so let's... talk a little bit about the one thing that I left hanging a little bit at the beginning. I said one of the things that is so important for meditation practice is the sila, the kind of conduct that we come into meditation with. And this is really what matters, is kind of the make or break of meditation, is whether we are able to have, really... The better our conduct, the more powerful our meditation tends to be. It's one of those very interesting things. If you look at, I mentioned before that Buddhism is all about causality, is about conditioning. What are the conditions that support other conditions? And if you read the suttas and the word of the Buddha, you find that the one thing that always supports mindfulness more than anything else is sila, it's morality, which is kind of very fascinating. It's a very common idea in the Buddhist world that it is mindfulness that leads to mindfulness. So if you are able to be mindful through the day, then you will be mindful when you sit in your meditation. But there isn't really any evidence for that in the suttas. The suttas, rather, the purpose of mindfulness in everyday life is so that we can actually be moral, we can live well, we can do the right thing. That is really the purpose of everyday mindfulness. So what supports our meditation practice is this idea of kindness and avoiding doing the wrong things in life. It's fascinating. It's very useful sometimes to have a little bit of insight into how the Buddha taught these things, because sometimes you realize that things are actually a bit different from how they are often taught in the Buddhist world. A lot of people have never really read the suttas. They don't really know exactly how the Buddha taught. And it opens up another window, another avenue to understanding how the Dhamma really functions. How then can we maximize our good conduct? And there's a number of ways of doing this. One of the problems is that to be able to have good conduct consistently, if you want to always do the right thing, say the right thing, even think the right thing. It really, everything that we do and act and speak, it comes from one place, obviously. It comes from the mind. It comes from our intentions. And because it comes from the mind, it is actually very valuable and very useful to work directly with the mind. Change our outlook. Think about the world in a new way. Yeah, and alter the way that we relate to the world mentally. Because by doing that, you're kind of combining all of morality into one thing, yeah? Because everything is rooted in our mind. As it says in the very first verse of the Dhammapada, yeah? I'd really recommend you to read the Dhammapada. It's a very inspiring and beautiful little book. Yeah? As it says there, it says that the mind is forerunner of all things. Yeah? All things come out, and that has a broader idea than just this. But this is one of the ideas behind that, that everything we do, all our ability to live well, etc., comes from the mind, how our mind has been developed. So it is kind of obvious, yeah, but what it means is that if we can deal with the mind directly, we're actually doing something very useful for our own practice. And the most obvious things that are problematic, of course, is to kind of be able to move from getting upset and angry with people in the world. People are usually the biggest problem in life. So moving from getting upset with people, getting irritated by people, to having more time for people, more kindness, more care, more compassion, more understanding. This is really kind of almost the golden aspect, the golden what really matters on the Buddhist path is part of the idea of right effort, and right effort leads directly to right mindfulness on the Buddhist path. And it's fascinating. I actually love to talk about this, and it's something that I talk about quite often, especially on retreats, because I think it is so fundamental to the Buddhist practice. And sometimes I'm surprised. There have been people who have been, coming to the Buddhist Society, coming to my retreats for years and years and years, and still sometimes they kind of get these things slightly wrong, yeah? And so sometimes I know with myself as well how I need to hear these things again and again and again before they really kind of hit home, before they actually have a real power in my practice and actually enable me to use these things in a powerful way. Everything in Buddhism is about habit. It's about learning things again and again and again. And as you hear them again and again, they start to sink in and they start to gain a certain power in your life. It's amazing how long it takes sometimes. I'm sure many of you will notice that. I've certainly noticed that in my own life. How long it takes for these ideas really to penetrate deeply inside, so that as to enable us to change the course of our lives in a more profound way. So one of the ways that the Buddha talks about overcoming ill will and moving towards kindness, moving towards metta, well, one of the things that the Buddha says, and this is I think an important point to understand how to actually practice metta properly, in other words, loving kindness properly. In the simile of the saw, which is one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 21, he says in there that when you do metta, you should start out with a person who is difficult. Yeah, the person you may be a bit angry with or upset about. That's where you should start. And it's kind of fascinating. What do you mean, start with the most difficult person? That's impossible. I've got to start with the friends, right? How can you start with the most difficult person? And the point is that it is the assumption is that for someone who is really practicing the spiritual life, the assumption is that we don't have any enemies. Yeah, you can't really afford to have any enemies on the spiritual path. And this is because if you have an enemy, you're basically going backwards. You're basically not ready to die. How can you die and have an enemy in your life? You have to be free of all those burdens in life. You can never really afford to have an enemy. So the assumption is, when we're practicing metta, is that we don't have any enemies. And then if some kind of ill will or negativity arises against somebody, in your life, which of course it will do, even if you don't have any real enemies. Sometimes negativity and negative things will arise. Then you have to deal with that first to overcome it. And when you overcome that, well, only then is it really possible to have metta for all beings in all directions, because the hindrances, the blockages for having that metta have been abandoned. So for this reason, we need to learn how to kind of shift our mind and to move it in a different direction. When you sit down to meditate, for example, do you have any negative thoughts at that particular point? Well, if you do, that is always a good time to shift your attitude right there as you start out to do your meditation practice. You cannot really meditate if you are upset or angry about anything. That just doesn't work, because your mind is going to be really distracted. So deal with these things straight away. Ideally, deal with them even before you sit down, so you don't carry this with you into your meditation practice. And then there is a chance that you will have some kind of success. So how do we do this? And this is all explained in a very beautiful way in the suttas, how to deal with ill will. And I think these are the kind of suttas that we should really focus on again and again and again, because they are so fundamental to this whole practice of Buddhism. And the sutta found in the Anguttara Nikaya, these are the numerical discourses of the Buddha in the 5th chapter, sutta number 162, I think it is. And it's called the abandoning of resentment or ill will. And in this sutta, the Buddha gives these beautiful similes. Suttas are full of similes. It's one of the marvelous things about the suttas. It is beautiful similes of how to deal with difficult people in your life. And there's always going to be difficulties. But this one simile, he says that the way to deal with ill will against someone is like if you are a rag-robed monk, or a nun maybe, who has a robe of rags. Sorry, I can't show you a rag robe. This is like a really nice robe I've got here. Maybe I should, next time I'll remember to bring a rag robe so you can see what they look like. They look like a Christmas tree. Yeah, they're pretty cool, actually, these rag robes. I used to have one a long time ago. I was really attached to that rag robe. Yeah, it's supposed to be the other way around, right? You have a rag robe so you don't get attached. Okay, so I'm going to have to think about that. Well, actually, I wasn't that attached to it. I'm just messing around. But it was kind of cool to have a rag robe. Yeah, and I would wear that through the airports of the world. Yeah, people would look at me as if I was completely nuts. What is this fellow up to, wandering around with a shaven head? And it looks like it looks really strange. So the rag robe bhikkhu, if you have a rag robe, you're always on the lookout for rags, because a rag, you can sew it into your robe. When you have rags, the robe is very vulnerable, it tears very easily, the patches come apart, you always need some more patches to patch it up. So you're always on the lookout for rags, So when you walk along the street, you kind of, if you see a rag on the side of the street, yay, a rag, or you go in the city or wherever it is, you can find a rag, you will take the opportunity. And sometimes they would even find rags on the charnel grounds. Yeah, there's a really nice story about this in the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya Pitaka is the rules and the conduct and the observances that the monastic community is supposed to keep. Yeah, so it's full of all these procedures and things. And there's a story of a rag robe bhikkhu. And this rag robe bhikkhu, he goes to the charnel ground. The charnel ground is the place where they burn the corpses. Yeah, they put the corpses on a pile of wood, and they kind of put it all, they light it all up, and then it burns. Yeah, the whole thing kind of burns as a consequence. But sometimes the corpses, they lie around for a while before they get burned. So this bhikkhu, this monk, he goes to the charnel ground. There's a corpse in the charnel ground. And this corpse, they're always wrapped in cloth. So the bhikkhu, yay, cloth. Okay, I'm a rag robe bhikkhu. There's cloth for me. So he starts to unwrap the cloth from this corpse. And then as he unwraps the cloth from the corpse says, "Don't take my cloth." This is in the suttas, it's in the Vinaya. Don't take my cloth.
And the vicar kind of, what? You're dead, for goodness sake, shut up. You're not supposed to say anything. What is going on? So the vicar thinks, oh yeah, dead anyway. So he carries on and he takes all the cloth off this corpse. And then when he has taken all the cloth off and is about to walk off, the corpse rises up and starts walking behind him. Give me back my cloth. And the monk looks over his shoulders and he starts to run, and he runs back to his cootie. And just as he gets back to his slams his door. And as he slams his door, the corpse falls down just outside his own cootie. And the monk kind of goes, oof, okay, whoa, that was a close call. And so that then becomes a rule for the monks. Yeah, this story becomes a rule. And the rule is that you're not allowed to take the cloth of a corpse unless the corpse is already cold. You have to wait for the corpse to get cold. Yeah, if the corpse is still warm, it means that the spirit might still be around. It might get up. It might run after you and you get into trouble. So that is actually a rule in the monastic vineyard. You're not allowed to take cloth of corpses that are not fully cold yet. So I tell you, the monastic vineyard is very, very interesting. Yeah, we are full of stories. Not full, but we have quite a few stories like that are really out there. And I always like to say that if you think that the zombie idea, the idea of zombies, is started in the Buddhist suttas. That's where you find the zombies the first time around. The zombies, that's not a kind of a modern invention at all. It goes back to the time of the Buddha. So much started with the Buddha and the Buddhist monastic books is kind of fascinating here. So anyway, so that is just one of those stories that are really kind of out there and really unusual. But it kind of fascinating that these things are there. And I sometimes wonder whether actually it is possible even. Can you have zombies? Can you have the consciousness maybe going back into the body? If you have a very strong attachment maybe it can happen. Yeah, maybe these things are possible. Maybe the idea of zombies is not entirely wrong. There might be some truth to it. Sometimes there is some truth to these kind of strange ideas, and this might be one of those weird truths, partial truths anyway. But that's really beside the point, of course, but it's a nice little story. So then the monk, yeah, who is a rag-robe monk, yeah, he walks along the roadside, and when he walks along the roadside, he sees a rag on the roadside. He takes the rag up, he folds it out, yeah, holds it down with his left foot, spreads it out with his right foot, and then looks at the rag. And then when he sees the rag, he sees the good part, he sees the bad part, he tears off the bad part, throws it out because it is rubbish, and takes the good part, folds it up nicely, and takes it with him. That's what you do if you are a rag robe wearing bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. In the same way, the Buddha says, when someone, yeah, there are some bad qualities in a person, someone that you find it difficult maybe to have goodwill towards, what you do is that you kind of pull out all the good qualities in the person. You look at all the good qualities, you tear off the bad qualities, you throw them out because they are rubbish. Yeah, you chuck out those bad qualities. You take the good qualities, you fold them up, you take them into your heart, and you carry them with you into the future. And then, when you have those good qualities of that person with you, in your heart, carrying them with you into the future, it means that you have the ability to take that out at any time when there is a problem. Yeah, you can look at those good qualities, you can remind yourself of the good qualities in that person, and as you do so, you can overcome any kind of ill will that you may have towards that person. Yeah, and this is not very difficult to do, but it takes training, it takes practice, and that is really the critical thing. And if you use that training and practice in the right way, everyone is able to do this kind of thing. So what you have to do is you just have to remember, maybe there are some people in your life that you find a little bit difficult, yeah, a little bit irritating, or maybe a group of people, it can be anyone really. And then you have to remind yourself of the good qualities in those people. And you know, an Armadale group is a very good example, yeah? And all the people in the Armadale group are really marvelous people? Is that right? It's right, isn't it? Because people do not come to the Armadale meditation group unless you are a good person. What's the point of coming to a meditation group if you haven't already got good qualities? It's kind of madness to come and to do meditation practice and hear about Dhamma. If you are an utterly evil character, there's no chance you want to come to this kind of group. So people in the Armadale group are already really good people. They are very well intentioned. You're all very well intentioned. And I would say I am too, yeah? So because of that, it is not that difficult to see the good qualities. You remind yourself of all the good things that are there. You remind yourself of the underlying good intentions that are there. People who want to do the right thing in the world, not always succeeding, but that would be asking for too much, but at least wanting to do the right thing. And that is such a beautiful and valuable thing, that people want to do the right thing in this world. Our troubled world, we need more people who have the right intention, the right desires, and actually desire to do what is good for themselves and for others. And it is so worthy of respect when we have people like that in our lives. So remember that, yeah? Remember that when you come to the people around you, especially people who are close to you, people on the spiritual path, there are all of these underlying beautiful things there that you focus on. And then all the small things that might irritate you, that might upset you in a certain way, you let go of it. It doesn't matter. The big picture is beautiful. The big picture is worthy of respect. The big picture is something that you can delight in. That is what really matters. And when you do it in this way, then you are doing what is appropriate in this to make your own life better and to make you actually enable you in the long run to access meditation, all of the other good things on the spiritual path. And it is interesting, sometimes people, they ask, they say, well, but if we always try to see the good in other people, is that really being realistic? Is it really the case that people are always have good qualities? I mean, what this whole idea of seeing the good, aren't we really fooling ourselves a little bit by doing that? Isn't the purpose of the Buddhist path to see things in accordance with reality? We should see all the aspects, all the qualities of the people around us. Isn't that the whole point? And the answer to that question, which comes up occasionally, is that there isn't any quality, there isn't any real reality in terms of people. There isn't any real way of looking at people. People don't have certain qualities as fixed, real aspects of their personality. People are always changing. People are always moving around. One day you are really friendly and happy, another day you might be a bit grumpy. One person may like you, another person may not like you. Who is right? And the truth is that there is no way that we can grasp a person and say, this is the good quality, this is the bad qualities, because everything is always changing. Everything is always moving around. We have our own biases and delusions. So because there isn't any real truth that we can hold on to in regard to other people, there is another question that we have to ask. And the question that we need to ask is, what is the most beneficial way of thinking about other people? Not what is right, because there is no right. There isn't any solid personality under there. What is the beneficial way of looking at other people? And the beneficial way, both for our us and for the other person, yeah, is to see their good qualities. And when we see that, we eliminate so much of the negativity inside of us. And then we can rejoice in their good intentions, giving them the benefit of the doubt, seeing the good aspects that are there. So this is the first simile of the Buddha that the Buddha uses in this particular sutta, yeah, to show how to overcome any ill will or negativity we may have towards other people. Another simile that he uses to basically express the same thing, this is the simile of the lotus pond. And the Buddha says it is as if a person is walking through the forest and they are weary, thirsty, and sweaty, and walking through the forest, and they are maybe a bit, weary. Usually means that you are a bit upset and angry about something. And then, as you're walking through the forest, you come to a lotus pond,
And this lotus pond, it has water plants and it has algae growing on the surface. Yeah. So then what you do when you come to this lotus pond is that you push the algae and water plants, you push them away, you push them aside. And as you push them aside, the water, the beautiful clean water opens up. And then you can dive into that clean water. You can drink in that beautiful water. And as you do that, you get rid of your thirst and the tiredness of the body. In the same way, when we see a human being, yeah, we push away the negative qualities. We don't focus on the bad qualities of the person. Instead of doing that, we push those aside. We don't focus on them. And we imbibe, we drink up all the good qualities in that person. The good qualities here are symbolized by the clean water under the algae and the water plants. And of course, when you imbibe them, it is as if you are filling yourself up, yeah, with these good qualities. It's a metaphor of filling up your mind with the good qualities of people around you. It's a beautiful metaphor of making it almost part of you, yeah, these qualities of the other person. And then you can move on. And of course, then you won't feel that upset with the person anymore. So that is the two qualities about how to move from seeing the good qualities away from the bad qualities to seeing the good qualities. But the Buddha, or in this case, Venerable Sariputta, he gives us also another tool. And this is the tool, what happens if you meet someone you cannot see any good qualities in? Yeah, it's a very important point. What happens if you meet somebody, they have their speech is really bad, their bodily conduct is bad, their mind is really polluted, all kind of things. What do we do then? Yeah, this gets difficult, because how can you have metta? How can you rejoice in someone else's good qualities if they haven't got any? And this is where the idea of compassion comes in. And what the simile that the Buddha uses is the simile of someone who is sick, someone who is ill. And this is the person who is walking in the desert, maybe, in a place where there are no people, there are no medicines around, there is no doctor around, there is no village either in front or behind, there is nobody to look out for this person. And yet, as they are walking in this wilderness by themselves, they are sick and gravely ill. Yeah? And then another person comes along and they see this person walking in the wilderness, really sick, without any kind of attendant, without any kind of medicine or food or anything at all. And this other person feels a sense of compassion. Yeah, that's what you do when you see someone who is really sick and they haven't got anyone to help them. He feels a sense of compassion and sympathy. And he feels, oh, may this person, may they find an attendant. May they find some medicine, some food, somebody to look after them. Yeah, may they find that, because if they don't find that, they were going to die. Or if they don't die, they're going to get really, really in a bad way regardless. And it's such a beautiful way of thinking about people with bad qualities. Yeah, if someone is full of bad qualities, they are basically sick. They are ill. They have no idea what they're doing. They're heading towards something terrible. Their future is like almost foretold, because if you are full of bad qualities, well, they feel bad right here and now. And also, they're moving towards even more problems in the future. This is the terrible thing about having so many bad qualities. So you have compassion for them. You regard them as a sick person. They are someone who are walking around in darkness. They're someone who is deluded. They're someone who doesn't know what they are doing to themselves. Yeah, when we're walking around in darkness and we don't know what we're doing, we are stubbing our toes and hitting our head on the, you know, in the ceiling perhaps. And we have no idea what we're doing because of that delusion, of that darkness in our life. So when you see people like that, remember that, yeah, they are like sick people. They have no idea what they're doing. They may be hurting you, because bad people, they tend to hurt others. They may be hurting you, but they're hurting another person far more than they're hurting you. And the person they're hurting the most of all is themselves. They're hurting themselves far more than they're hurting you, thinking that they're living in a good way, thinking that they're doing the right thing, thinking that they're doing something which is going to be work out for them in the long run. Well, actually, all they are doing is creating suffering for themselves. So what we're doing by thinking like this, Yeah, usually in life when people are very difficult and are hard to, I'm going to just go on for a couple of more minutes. When things are difficult and with other people, then very often we think about me. They are doing bad things towards me. And we get very kind of self-centered about it. And that is natural. Don't blame yourself for getting self-centered. But of course we are self-centered if people are, you know, difficult or whatever. But being self-centered and thinking about ourselves, it kind of traps us in a little world, in our own little world. And the world outside seems so dangerous and antagonistic and unfriendly towards us, because we are kind of creating this barrier between us and the world. And that is the problem here. Yeah, we are saying the world is bad and I'm here, I'm going to have to need protection from the world outside. That is what it's like when you see people like that. But if instead of thinking about me, instead of taking these things personally, instead of thinking that they are doing bad thing towards me and making it into a personal problem, instead, turn your attention towards them. They are the one who have the real problem. They are the one who are creating enormous amount of suffering for themselves in the future. I can bear with this. I only have to be here for a short time. Anyway, it is not personal. It's nothing to do with me. It has to do with them. If someone had been in my position right here and now, they would have had to feel exactly the same thing from this person. It is not personal at all. It has to do with the conditioning of the other person and the way they are. That is the real problem. And when you think like this, when you depersonalize the problem, when you realize it's not really about you at all, it's about the other person. And when you realize that they are creating enormous amount of suffering for them, for yourself, you can have compassion for the other person. And when you have compassion for your other person, instead of being trapped into your own little world, your own world, me world, and seeing the world as scary, instead your mind expands out and encompasses the whole world with this beautiful feeling of compassion and metta combined, where you care for the world and you look after the world instead of feeling excluded and separated from the world around you. And it's marvelous when that works, because it transforms the whole problem. And instead of having things which block you in your meditation, you're opening up a possibility which is radically different. And you are gradually transforming your heart, transforming your entire way of dealing with the world. So this is really what I think I would really recommend you to focus at least somewhat on in your practice. And as you do that, what you will find, as I mentioned initially, is that your entire conduct is affected by this. Yeah, your mental conduct is obviously affected by this. But you will also find that the way you speak, the way you act, everything starts to change as a consequence of this. And perhaps most importantly of all, if you are part of the Armadale Meditation Group, is that your meditation starts to improve, yeah? Because you have less enmity to the world. You have more compassion for everyone. And these are the kind of feelings, the inner feelings, that will enable you to be mindful, to be in the present moment, and to take the meditation much further into the future.